Stitcher, smart radio mobile app, offers this podcast and over 5,000 other podcasts and programs without downloading or syncing at the iPhone or Android app stores or at Stitcher.com.
That's my purse! Stop him! Stop! Somebody please help me!
Go get him!
Thank you, officer.
Yeah, it's great, lady.
My old bad, Sanchez. He's running around playing cop, assaulting and beating people.
Police! Drop the guns!
An anonymous, apparently off-duty police officer interrupted a robbery tonight, heroically confronting an armed robber with only bottles of spaghetti sauce.
He used to rob people who robbed people.
Kind of like Robin Hood?
Yeah, except I didn't give the money to the poor people.
Well, the bellman also said the guy had a hooker with him.
Buy a nice little house with a white picket fence. You live happily ever after.
I tell you what, let's go straight to the happily ever after part, okay?
Junior could be anyone he wanted to be.
Frederick J. Fringer.
Herman Gottlieb.
I got something on the real Gottlieb.
You can call me Junior.
Mugged, DOA at the San Francisco Airport Hospital.
Wouldn't use his real name.
Sergeant Hope Mosley, homicide.
You ain't no cop. Oh, I'm a cop.
Making arrests?
Police raid! Everybody freeze!
Maybe you should wait and let him solve a couple more for your caseload, huh?
Stop or I'll shoot! You just shot me!
Fired a warning shot and hit you.
Unfortunately, the person he decided to be wants Junior dead.
Hair trigger.
Stole my gun, my badge, my teeth.
Now you stay out of crime.
I promise.
Police officer!
Police! Miami Blues.
Welcome to another episode of The Projection Booth. I'm Mike White. Joining me is regular Projection Booth co-host Rob St. Mary.
I was hoping for another slice of that vinegar pie, sir.
Well, maybe a little bit later on. And special guest, author Scott Phillips.
Hello. I'm glad to be here.
Glad to have you, sir. This week, we're looking at the 1990 film Miami Blues. Written and directed by George Armitage, Miami Blues is an adaptation of the Charles Williford novel of the same name. The film tells the story of Freddie Fringer Jr., a sociopath who comes to Miami for a change of scenery and a new venue for crime. Fresh off the plane, he breaks the finger of a Hare Krishna at the airport. The Krishna dies, and this sets off a wild chain of events where he gets to meet crusty detective Hoke Mosley and naive prostitute Susan Wagoner. That's really just kind of scratching the surface of this film. Our three main characters, Freddie, aka Junior, Susan, and Hoke, are our focus, but the movie is filled with some great quirky characters, kind of typical of Charles Williford's work. So Scott, when did you first get exposed to Charles Williford?
Well, you know, the first person I can remember talking about him was James Crumley, and I didn't actually read Williford until after he had died. Dennis McMillan, who published several of Williford's books posthumously and was a friend of Williford's, gave me a copy of Kiss Your Ass Goodbye in the early 90s. That was part of a novel that Williford never published in his lifetime called The Shark-Infested Custard. I read that and I thought, wow, where have I been? Why did I not know about this guy? So I started reading everything I could get my hands on, including an unpublished Hoke Mosley novel called Grimhaven that Williford wrote because after he'd written Miami Blues, which is a big success commercially, his editor and his agent wanted him to do another Hoke book. And Williford had no interest in doing that. He intended the novel to be a one-off, and he didn't want to do a series. So he wrote this novel in which Mosley does something really awful. And his wife read it, and she was horrified, and his agent read it and was horrified, and his editor said, let's just pretend you didn't write this. And he recycled a lot of it for the other Hoke books. And the Hoke books were very successful. They were the last books he wrote, and I think they're very good. I think he, you know, kind of died at the height of his powers, but he really hadn't wanted to do a series.
When it comes to Williford, I mean, why is he of an interest to you as a writer? Why do you, why are you attracted to him? What's different about his work than, say, other crime writers?
It's the point of view. I mean, I, you know, in a way, he's not really even a, he's a crime writer, but he's not a mystery writer. He's interested in crime, but he's mainly interested in aberrant behavior. He specialized in what one critic, and I can't remember who it was, it may have been an editor, he specialized in what this person called the asshole protagonist. I think that's what appealed, because I like that too. I mean, I like to, the unsympathetic protagonist that you nonetheless can't help following. And that's kind of Freddie Frenger Jr. in this movie and book.
Well, I would say even Hoke Mosley is a little bit of an a-hole at times, too. Yeah. He's always concerned about how much work he has to do. He's always, you know, complaining about how much money he gives to his wife and daughters for alimony.
Yeah.
And he's not happy at all.
He's a seething cauldron. It is interesting because, you know, in Hollywood, you always get this question, who am I rooting for? You know, you go in and do a pitch and they'll say, well, I don't know. The point of view, it's too diffuse. Who am I rooting for? Every time somebody tells me who am I rooting for, I know I'm dealing with a moron. And this is one of those movies where you don't know who you're rooting for. And that's part of what makes it so enjoyable, I think, is that, you know, who's the star of the movie? Is it Alec Baldwin? Well, Alec Baldwin is on the cover. You know, he's on the cover of the DVD. He's on the poster. Is it Hoke? Well, you know, Fred Ward produced the movie. Hoke is certainly the good guy to the degree that there is one. Is it Susie, the young prostitute? Because she's really the only innocent one. It's a very diffuse point of view. It starts out being Baldwin's movie, and it ends up, I think, being Hoke's movie, and somewhere in there, it's Susie's movie.
It's funny to compare how Susie is from the book to the screenplay to the movie, the final film, because I think they really do kind of make her more and more innocent as it goes along. You're right.
And they flesh her out.
She's so naive in the movie.
But she's figuring Freddie out, and Freddie figures her out quite a bit earlier. It's interesting also because the relationship between Freddie, he really in the book has this sort of contempt for Susie and really wants to get rid of her quite a bit earlier than in the film. In the movie, there is this kind of, I mean, Freddie's Junior is a sociopath and a psycho and everything, but he does have this sort of tenderness toward Susie. And in the book, it's a lot, it's a little nastier.
We should talk about the book for a little bit because there are some major differences between the book and the screenplay and the final film. I'll set up the timeline a little bit here. So the book was published in 84. Fred Ward bought the property in 86. The screenplay was written by George Armitage, the director, in 88, the one version that I have anyway. And then it finally opened in theaters with a lot of changes between that screenplay and what we saw in, I believe, April of 1990. So in between there, you've got a span of 6 years and a whole lot of different people kind of involved in it. Originally, Fred Ward was producer, and then he was also going to be the star. He was going to be Junior, and Gene Hackman was going to play Hoke Mosley, which would have been very interesting.
That would have been amazing, yeah.
Yeah, that's why Gene Hackman is thanked in the end credits. He was originally there, and then they brought in Baldwin to do some stuff, to do a reading, and they were so impressed by him that they ended up offering him the junior role, and basically Ward was like, do you mind if I take this, Gene? And apparently Hackman was very pleasant about his bowing out of the project, so it became more of Fred Ward's movie. So we should say in the book, it does start the exact same way with Freddie on the plane landing and breaking the finger of the Hare Krishna, which puts him into shock and then kills him, which is just a wonderful way to die, or to kill someone in a book, I should say.
And that's pure Williford, too. That's
right. Oh, yeah. That guy, that Hare Krishna, is key to the book because he is actually the brother of Susie.
Right.
Which is just one of these absolutely bizarre coincidences that I don't think you would necessarily believe in a movie. And pretty much right out of the gate, I think Armitage realized that and killed that line of thought right there.
Right. That's what brings Hoke and Junior and Susie together in the book. And so in the movie, he has him trailing Junior as a suspect. And that's how they come together.
The whole tracing of the suede sport coat.
The suede sport jacket, yeah. And it's an interesting, this is a tangent here, but there's a great moment at the end of the movie where he breaks up the gambling den, and Junior breaks up the gambling den pretending to be a cop, and he's saying back to the gambling to the gambling den guy lines that Hoke has said to him, like, do you own a suede sport jacket? And they just make no sense at all. And the guy's thinking, who is this guy?
You out at the airport today? I was high out at the airport today. What, are you crazy? You ever stood in a lineup before?
Well, yeah, I stood in a lineup before.
Okay, I want you to line up.
Hey, what the hell's going on here?
Shut up!
You own a suede sports coat? Courtesy then. You ain't no cop. Oh, I'm a cop.
He's sort of taking over Hoke's persona. He's not just being a cop, he's being Hoke.
The other thing that I found very interesting in the screenplay, which ended up being a little bit in the final film, which was the whole Frisbee motif, where in the screenplay, once Junior is free and he's in Miami, and it's before he even gets real lay of the land, he's at the first hotel, and he buys a couple Frisbees and goes up on the roof and throws them out basically to Miami. And it's almost like, is anyone going to throw this back to me? And then later on, I think it's right after he beats up Hoke and takes his badge and gun and teeth. Then he sees some people, actually in the screenplay, I think it's two kids and a three-legged dog, and they're throwing the Frisbee to each other. And that's still in the movie. It's not a two kids and a three-legged dog, but it's this nice silhouette of these people on a beach playing that. But you don't have that first Frisbee moment of the rooftop. And later on, you see Junior and Susie actually playing Frisbee. So it's like, okay, he's finally found somebody. And that's kind of, like you were saying, as far as his changing, you know, and he actually does try to lead the straight life for about 5 minutes.
Yeah, not very hard, but he does try.
Then he definitely pays the price for it by almost getting run over by a truck.
And then he and then Hoke and Susie at the end of the movie have a little toss back and forth.
This film, it always reminds me of like one of the best films Jonathan Demme didn't direct, because it feels like a Jonathan Demme movie all the way through it. I mean, you've got Tak Fujimoto, his usual DP, is the DP on this. And you've got so many actors that he has worked with before, Demme has worked with before, like Charles Napier is in here. And I love Charles Napier. He plays Hoke's partner.
He's great in everything he's in, too. I mean, it's just surprising that to me that he didn't become a star, because he is one of those actors who tends to dominate a scene. Think about him, even in just the really awful things, you know, like the space hippie in Star Trek. Yeah, he's great in that. He's like, who is that guy?
He really came into his own with all of the Russ Meyer films. Really did a great job in that. I mean, even his small role in Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, it's just like, who is that guy? He is great.
That was the thing also with him, is that I can't, as I was watching Miami Blues, I couldn't remember off the top of my head all the various things I'd seen him in before, but I remembered seeing him and the impact that he had. Like, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's like, I can't sit here and give you his filmography, but it's like, when you see him, you know him, and you're like, you always know it's a good time, because he was always really dead on like that. And getting back to the thing you were talking about, Mike, this connection to Jonathan Demme, I mean, obviously he produced it, and it does seem sort of in the mold of some of the things he was doing in the 80s, like, you know, Something Wild and stuff like that. I mean, it has that kind of sensibility. So in your research at all, do you know if maybe this was something that even he was interested in doing, or?
I don't know. I have no idea who else was interested in this. I know, you know, Williford had an interesting connection to the movies. He's been filmed three times. The only one he lived to see was Cockfighter. The other one, the third one, was The Woman Chaser. And to varying degrees, they were all faithful to the work. I mean, Cockfighter was very faithful, and because he was involved with it. He was closely involved, and he actually played a role. This is probably the least faithful to the letter, but it's very faithful to the spirit of his work. The Woman Chaser is so faithful that it even leaves in stuff that, you know, somebody who's familiar with the book would just assume that you'd have to leave out, just crazy stuff. But to me, that's what makes it wonderful, is that they did leave in all the crazy stuff that Williford just threw in there, and because he found it interesting or funny. This is obviously a more commercial film, and they took out a lot of a little bit of the goofy stuff. But I think it's still very faithful to his notion of those characters. Junior really is very, very much the way he is on the page. And I think Hoke, if this movie had been more successful, they might have done all four novels, you know, with Fred Ward as Hoke.
You talk about some of the little strange, quirky little things that would be throwaways in other films. And the one thing that comes up several times, and you guys talked about it a little bit, but there's one image of it that I really love, is when Hoke goes back to his apartment, you know, in this little hovel of a place that he lives, and takes his teeth out and puts them in a glass of whiskey. I just thought, yeah. I don't know why that image works for me, but it says so much. It just says so much about who he is and what he is, and it's just a brilliant idea. There's several other things within the film that also kind of speak to these things within the characters, where nobody really has to explain why these things are done. And I think the other one is when Jennifer Jason Leigh's character makes the pie for Junior. And obviously she goes way overboard with the amount of vinegar that she puts in it. But to me, what it said, and I don't know if you guys got this or not, was it was her way of testing him for the truth, to see if she could trust him. And it was like, I showed you something that's obviously bad, and you sit here and grin at me and say that it's good, that I know you're a liar.
And at the end, she tells Hoke, he never hit me, and he ate everything I made for him.
Yeah, and that whole pie thing is not, I mean, they talk about vinegar pie in the book.
There's a recipe for it at the end of the book, yeah.
The book doesn't turn on the pie, and neither does that initial screenplay that Armitage wrote. That pie came in later, and I think it's just super effective the way that they use that in there.
The thing that's interesting for me about that scene first is that it's so minimal in terms of its setup to bring out that understanding between the characters. But there's also another level on this, and if I'm correct, I believe it was Jennifer Jason Leigh was in the running around the same time as when this movie came out, maybe a little later, to play the Julia Roberts role in Pretty Woman, and turned it down because she thought that the idea of that prostitute character in that film was sort of immoral and not at all.
It's a horrible movie. Yeah. It's like, you know, I was listening to Gary Marshall on the radio yesterday talking about that movie, and he's got a book to promote. And I get letters from girls who tell me, oh, you're the reason I came out to Hollywood to be a hooker. You know, it's like, yeah, he didn't really say that, but but this is a movie. Yeah, this is a movie that's a little bit realistic about hooking. Not super realistic, but something like Pretty Woman is, God, it's an insulting movie. It's an insult to the intelligence of the human race.
I just thought it was interesting that I'm pretty sure that she was up for that role and then was like, well, I can't really play it that way. And it's interesting that just around the same time, maybe even before, she had done this role, which is not similar, but still within the same, I guess, profession, per se.
Yeah. In a way, this is kind of like the nasty crime movie version of Pretty Woman.
Yeah, I have to say, the one thing that I'm sad they cut out of the movie was the anal sex, because Williford was a big proponent of anal sex.
Yeah, well, have you ever read his Something About a Soldier, his memoir of serving in the Philippines? He talks about the prostitutes there and how, you know, he gets into it quite a bit. Yeah, at a certain point, you know, when they're talking about having babies, which in the movie is a slightly different thing, but he says, well, if we ever got around to doing it the other way, you know, we could discuss having babies. You know, Williford was really, really dark, but he was also very, very funny. And that's another thing that drew me to him, was that his books are just insanely funny. You know, not Carl Hiaasen funny, but more like Whistling Past the Graveyard funny.
Yeah, what is it about Florida and crime writers, do you think? Because it's, I mean, as I was, you know, researching this one, I kept thinking about, you know, John D. McDonald and Hiaasen and all these other Florida crime writers. I mean, is it just something in the atmosphere down there or what? Do you know any crazy Florida writers that are still going on?
I think what you've got in Florida, James W. Hall, I think what you've got in Florida is this really volatile mix of cultures. You've got the exiled Cuban community. You've got snowbirds from the northeast. And you've got rednecks from North Florida, and you've got this really heady, you know, they don't all like each other. Those things are like, you know, weather patterns. They, you know, the high pressure front and the low pressure front, and, you know, they bump together and you get a tornado.
And that's the thing that's also interesting about Florida, in that it's not a like you were talking about in terms of the culture there, is that it's not really a southern state, but it is. In that, you know, when we think south, we think, okay, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia. But Florida still has, like you were saying, because of the snowbirds, Jewish population, all of these things, it has some more sophisticated northern ideas at the same time. So it's not all backwoods when we think of the south, you know, at least the stereotype.
Jacksonville. Yeah, but up north you get Jacksonville, and that's pretty Confederate, you know. And then you got the swamps, and you got the whole, yeah, it's a peninsula, you know, so you got the ocean all over the place, and you get the swamps, and it's, you know, it's a pretty fertile ground.
Yeah, even on TV right now, I mean, we've got Burn Notice, which is all set in Miami, and The Finder, which is in Miami, too. I mean, it's just kind of carrying on this tradition of Miami crime stuff, and Miami Vice, as it
Miami
were.
Miami Vice,
uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yes.
And Scarface, the Al Pacino.
Oh, and it's funny because there's a moment when Junior in the movie is talking to himself and he's doing all the voices. He's having a conversation about, you know, buying a car, and he says, "Are you sure you'd want to buy this car?" You know, he's doing a generic Cuban car salesman, but he's also doing Pacino doing a Cuban accent.
Him with that machine gun, too, is pretty great, that Uzi squirt gun.
Yeah. Yeah. And him doing those crimes, those are great scenes. I mean, when he is on his spree, whether it's the spree of stopping crime or pretending to stop crime or just committing crimes, he's pretty great. I mean, those scenes are pretty strong.
You know, you had mentioned the other books, and Williford did Grimhaven, yep, right out of the gate afterwards, which was great that he goes and tries to make Hoke basically a murderous psychopath in the second book. Kind of brings back some of those ideas for New Hope for the Dead, but really, I think it's in Sideswipe, which is the third book, where he has Hoke go a little crazy. Not as crazy as Grimhaven, but he's got him kind of comatose.
He gives Hoke eventually a loving, though strained, relationship with his daughters, who he eventually ends up with custody of. And Elena Sanchez, who is his partner in this movie after Napier retires, which is kind of an interesting thing. It's like Napier, it's the old, I've got a week before I retire, and, you know, it's the only movie where that ever happened, where the cop who's going to retire doesn't get killed. But Elena Sanchez is played in the movie by Nora Dunn. And it's interesting because I remember Nora Dunn from Saturday Night Live, and it really struck me in this movie. She was really very beautiful and really a good actress. I mean, if I hadn't known it was Nora Dunn, I would not have, you know, it wouldn't have occurred to me that it wasn't actually a Cuban-American actress.
Yeah, had you told me that Nora Dunn was going to play a Cuban-American, I would have been like, no. Especially after seeing her, you know, on SNL for all those years and doing, you know, clang clang with the trolley and all that kind of stuff. But you know who really stuck out for me was Paul Gleason in his little role here, where he comes in as the vice cop who Freddie had set up Hoke, and oh my gosh, he is great. I love how he's just so corrupt, but he's still, you know, criticizing Mosley for living in this kind of crappy hotel.
Pablo sent this.
What?
What's the matter, Sarge?
Got a guilty conscience.
He's gone to the hospital.
I know. I know all about you. I like your place here, too. It's very nice. You also got a little something that belongs to me, don't you, Gums?
The f*** are you talking about? Never seen you before in my life.
Now listen, Sarge. You think you're moving in on my territory? I think you better cough up some do-re-mi right now. $500, let's have it.
What $500? What are you talking about? Fuck off.
Fuck off? Fuck off? You go to Pablo, you cut yourself in on my action, you don't think I'm coming after you? Jesus Christ, you got a lot of balls.
And Pablo wants the hooker back on the job tomorrow at 10 o'clock, and all is forgiven, Gums.
What hooker?
He got your gun, and your badge, and your teeth. You are a disgrace to the police force.
It's a slightly different scene in the book. For one thing, the officer is African-American, and that plays into the thing. because later on Hoax says, well, unless the guy was blind, he knew I wasn't that guy. Couldn't have mistaken these two guys for one for the other. The cop is actually a little sympathetic in the book when he comes in. He says, man, I can see you're hard up for money based on where you're living, but I can't be splitting the money.
Yeah, and he throws his teeth out the window, if memory serves, as well.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
His new teeth.
And Hope has to go down and get them. Both the book and the novel get a lot of mileage out of those teeth, but in different ways. The teeth kind of have a different peregrination. And in the movie, it's very interesting because I don't know what Ward does something very interesting. The teeth are not really very, the fake gums are not very convincing, and Fred doesn't really look like he's missing. It's only the top set in the movie. He's never very convincing in terms of looking like he's missing teeth. But he's very convincing in looking as though he's defeated, and in the middle section of the movie, he ages. He really ages. He walks differently. He's stooped over. He's bent. And then when he gets the temporary set of teeth, he's a little bit better. And at the end of the movie, when he gets his own teeth back, because in the book, Junior throws the set of teeth away. In the movie, he keeps the teeth, and Hoke finds them and puts them back in his mouth at the very end. And Sanchez says, what's with you? You look different. And he's standing real tall, and he looks 10 years younger, and he says, I got my teeth back. And he does this really interesting thing where he goes from being this, Fred Ward, to being this old, bent, slow, creaky, half-crippled guy, and then goes back to being Hulk. It's a great performance by Fred Ward. And another thing that I love is he does a little Columbo thing. When he's having dinner with Susie and Junior and just tormenting Junior, when he leaves, he says, all right, ha, ha, ha. And then, oh, there's one more thing. He says, have you ever been in a lineup? Would you like to come down and be in a lineup? And it's great. It's just pure Peter Falk.
We're talking about that the vice cop was black. There's a lot of race stuff in the book, especially when it comes to his captain. And his captain was in the screenplay, but ended up getting cut out. Because his captain, I think, is the first black captain in the Miami Police Department. So he does anything and everything he can to make sure that he is as by the book as he possibly can be. And I love that about him. And I love that he's so concerned about where Hoke is living and that they have to use his partner's address for, any forms and all this kind of stuff. But there's a great joke that's in the book and in the screenplay, which is people keep coming up to Hoke when he's in the hospital and bringing him boxes of fudge. And they lie about where they get the fudge. They're always like, oh, yeah, my wife made this. And they're all the same box. And when he goes downstairs to the past the gift shop, he sees that fudge is on sale. Same box and everything. I love that part. I should say one more thing before we take a little bit of a break here, which is there are the four official Hoke Mosley books. And then I don't know if you've heard about this, but I've had the pleasure of reading. There's kind of a fifth unofficial one. A guy up in Seattle, Ken Kaufman, wrote a book called Fairhaven, which has a character that's very similar to Hoke Mosley, though it is in Seattle. It doesn't have that whole kind of Miami flavor to it. And I think his character's name is Jake Mosby. But kind of cantankerous, older guy. In this one, he inherits a bookstore when his father passes away. And it's really good. Very well written, good psychopathic character. He's kind of an angel of mercy character who goes into, he works at different old folks' homes and is kind of taking people before their time, really. But yeah, it's good stuff. If you ever get a chance, I highly recommend it.
Is it in print?
Yeah, in print. Just came out recently. And yeah, you can get a print copy or an ebook, whichever you want.
Yeah, I will seek it out.
All right, so we're going to take a little bit of a break, and we'll be back with more about Miami Blues.
Everyone wants to spice things up in the bedroom. Here's an offer you won't want to miss. For a limited time, you'll get 50% off just about any one item at adamandeve.com. Yes, get 50% off when you use the coupon code BOOTH at checkout, as in John Wilkes Powers or the Projection Booth. But that's not all. You'll also receive 3 free adult DVDs and free shipping on your entire order. Too good to be true? It's not. Check out adamandeve.com today for this special offer. Once again, that coupon code is BOOTH at adamandeve.com.
Thank you. traveled. ItFollows.net.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to Forgotten Flicks. I'm Joel, and I'm here, as always, with my co-host, Jason.
The whole point of the Forgotten Flicks podcast, the idea behind it, was that we wanted to create something, a mouthpiece for fans of movies from the 70s, the 80s, and the 90s, the movies that we all grew up with.
This was one of the worst movies I've seen in a long time.
You are full of crap. Are you being serious?
I will never, ever see him as anything else but Edgar. The cockroach guy from Men in Black.
Full Metal Jacket.
I loved it. His playing that Edgar role in Men in Black was hilarious.
Who do you think you are all of a sudden? I can't believe you hate this movie.
Everything is so contrived. Painfully so. I'm just going to read through my notes. And whether you remember the movies or you forgot about them or maybe you never even heard of the movies we're talking about, the point is that we're all keeping the memories of the movies we love alive.
Find us on iTunes or ForgottenFlicks.com.
Welcome back to the Projection Booth. This week we're talking about Miami Blues, the offbeat action comedy from 1990. Now, Mike, I understand you have a little bit of a history with this film, and you showed it last year on your book tour for Impossibly Funky, the collection of the Cashiers de Cinemark collection. Can you kind of tell me a little bit about your connection to Miami Blues?
Yeah, I got to show it at 92Y, this screening place in New York. It's really great. They do different movies every single week, and it's usually kind of offbeat kind of stuff. And I talked to those folks, and they were just like, yeah, sure, we'd love to have you do a little book signing and stuff. And got a fairly good crowd out there. We showed Miami Blues and Shock Treatment. The best part, though, was folks coming up to me after Miami Blues, a lot of people took off before Shock Treatment, coming up to me and saying, thank you for showing me this. I never would have seen this had it not been for this screening, because it kind of flew under the radar. A lot of people didn't see this the first time out, because I think, you know, kind of going back to Scott's point about, you know, Alec Baldwin is on the cover, he's on the poster, he's on the DVD. This really kind of was a weird, like, is this Fred Ward or is this Alec Baldwin's movie? And I think, you know, they really didn't know how to market this because it is very offbeat and there are, you know, these quirky characters in here. So it's just, I don't think they really knew what they had when they had it. So, and, you know, at the time, I mean, Orion released this in, I think, April of 90. And right beforehand, in March of 90, they released a Jonathan Demme film, which was Silence of the Lambs. So Orion was, and again, releasing that in March was kind of a weird thing. I mean, there was really lightning in a bottle to release it then and get the response that it did, to have legs all the way from March of 1990 to the Oscars the following year in 91 and just kind of sweep the awards. But, you know, I don't think Orion, other than that, was doing very well. So I don't think they really knew how to market his stuff as much as they really needed to. But that could just be me.
The other thing about this film that I wrote down in my notes and I really wanted to talk about with you guys is this is one of the most anti-suave crime films I've ever seen. And what I mean by anti-suave is that by the time you get to the mid-90s, all the cops, all the robbers are super hip. They're all talking in hip dialogue. They have all these pop culture references. They're really, like, really hip guys. These guys are really kind of beat up. They're kind of, you know, rough around the edges. Yeah. They're more realistic. They're not caricatures in that way. I mean, you could actually kind of meet people like this. And I think that that might also be a problem with it for some people, is that there's not that distance with seeing these people, because you're kind of like, yeah, you know, there's a lot of quirkiness in this movie that is really realistic quirkiness. It's not sort of hip quirkiness.
Right. I think that's very true. And there's something, you know, like, look at, you know, can you imagine a crime movie now where the cop protagonist lives in a dump? I mean, a really crappy residential hotel. It's kind of hard to picture. It's a relic of the past. I mean, what you were just talking about Silence of the Lambs, the way movies were released back then were very different. You could have a movie that was on screen for a year. And I was just thinking, there were a couple of visual cues where I thought, are they making fun of Miami Vice here, just in kind of the wardrobe? And it's hard to say, because it's so far removed in time that, well, maybe that's just what the wardrobe called for. But I thought there were a couple of occasions where either Hoke or Junior were kind of sartorially mocking Crockett and Tubbs.
Yeah, there's that moment when he gets onto the bus at the airport and he sits down next to the guy who totally looks like he's an extra from Miami Vice.
Yeah.
And not only that, but I think that there's one scene that almost looks like it was shot outside the same hotel as the big showdown with the guy in Scarface. It looks like the exact same hotel where, like, the big massacre happens, where they, like, have the chainsaw and they're going to cut the guy's arm off and all that. So I don't know if they did that on purpose, but to me, it like, echoed that. I don't think it was the scene itself. But like I said, it just kind of seems anti-hip. And maybe it's because there's not sort of this coolness factor or whatever to it that maybe they couldn't figure out how to kind of market it, because – like I said, there's really no character to root for. They're all kind of losers.
Yeah.
I mean, they're interesting to watch, but I think that that might be part of the reason why for a mainstream audience it didn't catch on, because there's no sort of like person that you could walk away with and go, I'd really like to be like that guy, or, you know, and feel good about
it. Yeah, I mean, Hoke, the good news, the thing that Hoke gets is he gets his teeth back.
Which I think is a good symbol. It's like, I've gotten my voice back, you know? It's like the use of teeth as an imagery or something like that in terms of a symbolism for the character.
Well,
that,
yeah, but in the concrete, you know, another thing they'll ask you in meetings, what does he want? What's the character want? And it's like, well, he wants his teeth back. it would not be an easy sell in today's Hollywood. He wants his teeth back. He's a toothless old guy. He wants his dentures.
Well, maybe it would play well in the retirement homes. I'm sure there's a lot of guys who in the retirement homes could relate.
The book actually name checks Polident.
I was trying to figure out which whiskey goes well with storing your dentures.
Probably Early Times.
I was going to say Early Times.
We're up here near the North Country. I was willing to go with Canadian Club.
Oh, I know. Wait, I know. It's Old Granddad.
The other thing that I really liked about the film as well that plays with it is the fact that the robber becomes the cop with Alec Baldwin doing all these things. And at the beginning, he's doing the crime because he's just the criminal. So, and then once he gets the badge and everything, it makes it so much easier for him to do the crime. And not only to do the crime from a place of just wanting to be a criminal, but at some points maybe trying to help, but maybe not.
When he shoots the stick-up guy at the outdoor cafe by the pier, it's hilarious. I mean, it's you know, it's terrible, but it's really funny. And I have to admit that I laughed out loud at the finger chopping, which I don't know why, but it's one of those things that's so horrible and graphic that I guess my natural nervous reaction was just to cackle.
Again, another great small role, but terrific performance by Shirley Stoller. That was great to see her in there.
It's a wonderful scene. It's like, what are these coins worth? Well, it's not a rare collection.
And that's almost word for word from the book, too, which is terrific.
You say these coins are stolen, Sergeant?
Mosley. Homicide. We picked him up on a fencing sting. We figured if we could get a line on the owners, we could solve the crime. Is this a valuable collection or what?
This is by no means a rare collection. Just a cursory look at these coins tells me they're in fair condition.
That was cursory. You ever seen them before?
Seen lots like them. What happened to your eye?
Car accident.
You should sue the doctor who sewed you up. You could make a bundle.
He said it'd be fine after it scarred over.
He lied. How come a homicide detective is so interested in stolen property?
First of all, that's confidential information. Second of all, I'll ask all the questions around here.
Rob, when I first suggested this one, I don't think you had seen Miami Blues before. So what were your initial impressions?
I hadn't seen it. I had seen the box art. And I was like, looks interesting. And obviously working in a video store, it's one of those box arts with, you know, Alec Baldwin on the front that you had seen quite a bit. But I had never gotten a chance to see it. And when I watched the film, I haven't read any of Wilford's novels. But just looking at the film, and as you were saying, the adaptations are a little different, but they did keep some of the quirkiness, is at times I was thinking – because the guy that I relate to in terms of, you know, sort of in the same age range, same era of crime writing is Elmore Leonard, with just sort of little quirkinesses and little strange things here and there with the characters. But there's obviously big differences between the two. But the one connection in between Miami Blues and Elmore Leonard is that George Armitage had done this remake of The Big Bounce a few years ago, which was based on Elmore Leonard novel and was a late 60s film, which I haven't seen, but I heard is not the best adaptation of Leonard's novels. So maybe at least for Armitage, there's an interest in both Williford and in Leonard. I don't know for you, Scott, if you see sort of a difference, a similarity between those two guys, because they were, I mean, age-wise, they're kind of in the same era, really?
They're the same generation, yeah. So there's definitely a connection between them. Leonard goes down a lot easier. Leonard is... an easier writer to digest. There's a reason that Williford has this hardcore of super dedicated fans, but not a huge wide audience, because he has this just really nasty sensibility. He was very unsentimental. Not that Leonard is sentimental, but he was very cynical, and he had this extremely jaundiced view of humankind. He writes it beautifully. And I think Leonard has a much wider audience because he is a little bit sunnier. His view of human nature is not quite as bleak as Williford's. There definitely is a link. They're both funny. They're both interested in just weird, eccentric characters. And they both, you know, they were both interested in how large, strange groups of people work together.
Leonard had obviously read Williford, because I think that's it's required by law now that every Charles Williford reprint have the "no one writes a better crime novel than Charles Williford" Elmore Leonard quote on the cover. I think that's been on the books for at least 10 years or more now, and I'm saying the law books, not on the actual other books, because I think it's been on there for longer than that. This almost kind of, I can see what you're saying, Rob. It definitely does have that kind of feel to it. The movie does. And this was a decade before Get Shorty. I mean, Leonard had been adapted so many times beforehand. I mean, you know, 52 Pickup and Way Back, you know, going farther back than that.
See, the thing with Leonard is that he really kind of hit big originally with an adaptation. They did 310 to Yuma, and they did some of his westerns like Hombre and stuff like that. And then when it got into the crime stuff, it really, as you were saying, it really didn't start to hit until mid-90s, where people could actually take his books and do decent adaptations, like Get Shorty, right, like Out of Sight.
Here's the thing about, take Get Shorty, for example. You have Chili Palmer at the center of it, who is he's a mob guy and he's a killer and everything, but he's a guy you can really stand. You want him to get what he wants. You want him to succeed. You really are with him, and in the end, he gets what he wants, which is he got a movie made. With Williford, what you have is the most sympathetic character is probably Hoke, and Hoke's kind of an asshole. And, you know, in the end, he gets his teeth back.
There's definitely no one there at the center as much as Chili Palmer. And then even when it comes to, like, Touch and some of these other ones, you definitely know who you are rooting for. And especially because these guys keep getting emasculated all the time. I mean, Hoke having his teeth removed and Freddie, you know, almost getting run over and having his fingers chopped off and all these horrible things. You don't really want to see your character go through that unless they, you know, it's something like a Steven Seagal film where they get the shit kicked out of them and then you know they're going to come back and kick ass, but you know that Hulk isn't going to come back and, you know, strap a couple bandoliers across his chest and start taking people out with machine guns or anything. He's much more low key than that. So, Scott, I want to ask you, you know, you've had your work adapted before. How is that as an author to see your work change from what you kind of, you know, gave birth to what you see up on the big screen?
It's a funny thing because it's really somebody else's thing by that point. The only big change that they made to my book when they adapted it was they changed the ending. And originally they didn't. Originally they shot the ending the way it was, and the test audiences were squeamish, so they gave it a happy ending. And I think that's what hurt it commercially. I think it hurt it commercially because the test market audiences are random people selected from a mall and not necessarily fans of kind of crime films.
Before we go on, I should probably say for folks listening at home that the book that Scott had adapted was The Ice Harvest, which came out as a movie in 2005 that Harold Ramis directed. When had you written that? What was the year that the book came out versus the movie?
The book came out, I think, in 2000, and I'd written it about, I'd finished it in 98.
Are there any other bites on some of your other properties?
None that I am supposed to talk about.
This is Charlie Arglis, the most talented mob lawyer in all of Kansas.
Did I mention to you that I really wish you wouldn't do that?
Yeah. Coffee told me.
I'm going to break his fingers.
As an attorney, I advise you to cease and desist.
I'm almost done. If you are what you do, and you never do anything, then, you know, what are you?
Our finest gifts we bring for.
How much?
$2,147,000.
Anybody but a lawyer would consider the consequences.
Does this mean you're rich, Charlie? Because if you are, we could run away together.
It is a thought.
Leaving Wichita? Damn right it's a thought.
I should be home in Kansas City watching my kids open their Christmas presents. Now I gotta waste the whole day looking for that nitwit.
Have you seen Charlie tonight?
No, you just missed him.
Maybe we should leave now.
In case you haven't noticed, there's a hockey rink out there.
Boy, I didn't realize how slippery that was.
You going somewhere, Mr. Arglis?
No.
That guy you thought might be looking for you? He is.
Just act normal for a few hours and we're home free.
Yo, ho, ho! It's good to see you!
I want to know, when I use the word normal...
I think I scraped my tummy.
If we're understanding it the same way, don't talk. Hurry up. Oh.
Yeah, oh.
You don't have any buds for this, do you? Everybody has regrets.
You're in love with me.
I've always liked you.
Mr. Arglis?
Ouch, that had to hurt.
Oh, yeah, sure did. If
you
let me
down, it's all right. Did you, Arglis?
Drop the gun.
How weird people get this time of year.
Yeah.
It's Christmas. Everybody's nice on Christmas.
Only morons are nice at Christmas.
What's that, Roy?
Damn, I took his gun. Guess he must have another one.
Must have.
When I get out of here, I'm gonna kill you.
You had mentioned a little bit earlier as far as a series with Fred Ward as Hope Mosley. I think that was the original plan, but I just don't think that this one did as well as it should have. And then there was talk afterwards, because after a while, Fred Ward kind of let the rights run out on this. And then after a little while, Curtis Hanson picked this up, and he was supposed to turn it into a series. They were saying of movies, but it might have been a good HBO series because it was going to be a series of films for HBO. So I'm curious what they would have done with it. And there was still interest, I guess, even recently, but I'm not sure where they're at with that kind of stuff.
The thing is, they're so time and place specific that I wonder, I suppose you would have to change them quite a bit at this point. It's 25 years anyway, since almost 30 since this one came out. And it's been 25 since Willifred died.
I'm sure you've read The Burnt Orange Heresy. There's been talk of that coming out as a movie for a long time.
Yeah, who is it that's doing it?
Well, I had read that it was the same guy who did In the Company of Men.
Neil LaBute.
Thank you. And then I contacted LaBute's people because I was going to ask him if he wanted to be on this episode. And they said, nope, that is not correct. He has nothing to do with that. Imagine the internet being wrong. I know it's tough to believe. So yeah, I tried to get so many folks for this episode. I tried to get Alec Baldwin, who's a little busy these days. I don't know, Jennifer Jason Leigh, Fred Ward. Actually, Fred Ward's people did finally get back to me. It took me forever to find them, find a good contact, said that he's not interested. And then for the last few months, actually since we did Darktown Strutters, I was really trying to get a hold of George Armitage back then because he wrote Darktown Strutters and couldn't get a hold of him then, finally found his info, got in touch with him, and then he and I have been kind of emailing back and forth, but he just seems really soured on the whole Hollywood thing. He does not want to talk about anything current or old, so...
I can understand that.
Yeah. I had to respect his decision to kind of say, no, I'm not interested, okay. So that's why we... don't have any proper interviews this week, but I'm glad that we can talk to you, Scott, as far as, you know, having a modern day crime writer.
I'm happy to pitch in.
Well, I appreciate that. So I want to know, can you tell us a little bit? I mean, I know that you've got The Adjustment is coming out in paperback any day now.
The Adjustment is coming out in June. Yeah. And I have a collection of short stories called Rum, Sodomy, and False Eyelashes that is available as an ebook from Concord ePress. And it will very soon be available as a print-on-demand. I have four other books in print. We'll see what happens next. I'm right now writing something that I'm conceiving as an e-book that I'm going to publish under a pseudonym, and it's going to be the worst book ever written because I think I could sell a lot of copies.
That book was already written.
Book ever written.
It's called Twilight.
I was going to say The Notebook by Nicholas Sparks, but anyway.
I think I can top that.
Wow.
Wow.
You've got your bar set, huh?
Yeah, I've got my bar set. I'm going to top The Notebook.
We're going to take a break and play a preview from next week's show.
You know what our rules are here.
I really couldn't help it, Signore, with all the horrible things they made me eat all day.
What is your name?
It's Doris, Mr. President. She's the most undisciplined of all our girls.
That's the way. That's right. Good dog.
One or another pair of buttocks belonged to a boy rather than to a girl, we might be influenced in making our decision, whereas it is essential that we all be completely objective.
True.
That presents a clever trap that I would prefer not to fall into.
I think that we fascists represent the only true complete anarchism on Earth once we have taken control of the state. In fact, the only real anarchism is that of power.
Excuse me, I would like to make a suggestion. Don't you think, Signora Maggi, that it would be appropriate, before beginning your narration, to show us your most attractive and desirable parts?
Certainly, with the greatest of pleasure. And now he begins. All the machines have started functioning.
That was a preview for Salo, the 120 Days of Sodom. I almost said 100 days, but that would have been shorting it by 20 days. Be sure to come back next week when we talk about this rather infamous final film from Pasolini. Hopefully by next week I will know how to pronounce his first name. And we'll be joined by Sexpert Fräulein von B.
I'm going to listen to that.
Okay, good. I hope you enjoy.
Well, I am definitely going to listen to that one.
Well, definitely. I mean, Williford was into anal sex, so I guess
120 Days of Sodom. As long as you don't shortchange me 20 Days of Sodom.
No. I'll give you the extra 20. So we might even make it 140 days.
If you order now.
Yeah, the DVD extras. 20 days, 20 more days.
Scott, what was the book that you put out that was kind of an interesting sales method that you were doing? I'm trying to remember the name.
Rut. I put it out from the Concord Free Press, and the notion is the Concord Free Press prints 3,000 copies of a book. No money changes hands. Everybody works for free. The author donates the right to publish 3,000 copies. The editors donate their time. The designers donate their time. The books have to be, you know, paid for by, you know, you have to pay for the paper and you have to pay for shipping. And the printing gets, you know, but everybody pretty much that can donates their time and energy. The books are then given away to anybody who requests one. And all that they ask is that if you take a book, you make a donation to charity or to a person in need, and that you report back to the Concord Free Press website who and how much, to whom and how much you gave. And to date, the press has raised about $250,000 for charity, which is about $50,000 per book.
Wow.
Yeah, I had this book that was kind of outside of my, it wasn't a crime book, it was a sort of a end-of-the-world science fiction kind of a thing. And they asked me if I had anything that would be appropriate for them, and I said, well, try this. So now it's also available as an ebook from Concord ePress, and it's going to be eventually available as a print-on-demand.
Can you tell us a little bit about Noir at the Bar?
Noir at the Bar was started in Philadelphia by Peter Razovsky, who, Mike, I think you know, who does the Detectives Beyond Borders blog.
Oh, yeah, great guy.
Yeah, he's a great guy. He's a lot of fun, and he came up with this idea that you could have readings at bars. And so he started doing that in Philly, and then Jed Ayers, my writing partner, and I started doing it in St. Louis. And we've had a lot of people come down. We had Frank Bill. We've had Dwayne Swazinski, Teresa Schwagel. We've had a lot of great writers. Matt McBride, who is somebody you're going to be hearing about, made his debut at Noir at the Bar. And it's just, you know, it's kind of a fun thing. People get up and they read their most disturbing, twisted stuff, and people get drunk.
Sounds like a good time. All right, Scott, so we're going to wrap it up. It has been great talking to you. I look forward to seeing you in November. Are you going to be at NoirCon?
I'm going to try.
Okay, I hope so. So, yeah, if we do, I'll buy you a drink for being on our show.
Well, I'm going to need it.
I hope folks will go out and pick up some of your stuff over at your website, which is scottphillipsauthor.com.
I have a small caveat. That website has not been updated in 8 years.
Oh, wow.
So
where's the best place for them?
Facebook and I don't know. But you can reach me at scott@scottphillipsauthor.com.
Well, we'll be linking to Scott's site or however way we can get a hold of you, maybe by Pony Express or Tin Can or whatever, Passenger Pigeon, at projection-booth.com. We'll also have links where you can buy Miami Blues, either the movie, the book, much, much more of Williford. You can learn more there as well. Stop by, leave us some feedback, what you like, what you hate, what you want to do the first day you get out of prison. You know, we have a huge prison population listening to the Projection Booth, and we look forward to talking to you soon and talking about more movies. Stick around.
sin.